Amid the general applause, and while the soup gave way to an enormous dish of lobsters, Mr. Simpson, who sat at Stephen's side, said, "I had no idea that the gentleman of the Navy ever wooed the Muse." "Had you not? Yet Mr. Mowat is exceptional only in the power and range of his talent. And when you join the Goliath, you will find the purser, Mr. Cole, and one of the lieutenants, Mr. Miller, who often contribute verses to the Naval Chronicle, and even to the Gentleman's Magazine. In the Navy, sir, we drink as much of the Castalian's spring as comes within our reach." They also drank even headier liquors, and although the Worcester's wardroom, being poor, could afford only the fierce local wine known as the Blackstrap, there was plenty of it within reach. And this was just as well, because after its spirited beginning the dinner party came dangerously near the doldrums. Those who had not sailed with Captain Aubrey before were somewhat awed by his reputation, to say nothing of his rank, while the presence of so many parsons called for a pretty high degree of decorum from all hands, and even remarks about the Brunswick's old-fashioned way of carrying her mizzen topmast staysail under the maintop were out of place when so many of the company could not tell a staysail from a spanker. The junior officers sat mute, eating steadily. Summers applied himself to the Blackstrap, and although he sniffed it scornfully, as one used to decent claret, he drank a great deal. The marine captain launched into an account of a curious adventure that had befallen him in Port of Spain, but realizing that its scabrous end was utterly unsuitable for this occasion, was obliged to bring it to a pitifully lame and pointless, though decent, conclusion. Gill, the master, tried hard to overcome his settled melancholy, but he could manage little more than a bright, attentive look, a fixed smile. Both Stephen and Professor Graham had retired into private contemplation, and while the company ate their mutton, little was to be heard but the sound of their powerful jaws, some well-intentioned, ill-informed remarks on tithes by Captain Aubrey, and a detailed explanation of the working of the double-bottomed defecator at the far end of the table. But Pullings sent the bottles round with more urgency than before, crying, "Professor Graham, a glass of wine with you, sir. Mr. Addison, I drink to your new floating parish. Mr. Wells, I'll give you joy of the Brunswick in a bumper, sir. Bottoms up!" Jack and Mowat seconded him, and by the time the pudding came in, the temperature of the gathering had risen to something more nearly what Pullings could have wished. The pudding was Jack's favourite, a spotted dog, and a spotted dog fit for a line of battleship, carried in by two strong men.
"Bless me!"
cried Jack, with a loving look at its glistening, faintly translucent sides.
"A spotted dog!"
"We thought as how you might like one, sir," said Pullings. "Allow me to carve you a slice."
"Do you know, sir," said Jack to Professor Graham, "this is the first decent pudding I've had since I left home. By some mischance the suet was neglected to be shipped, and you will agree that a spotted dog or a drowned baby is a hollow mockery, a whited sepulchre, without it is made with suet. There is an art in puddings, to be sure, but what is art without suet?"
"What indeed?" said Graham, "but there are also puddings in art, I understand, in the art of managing a ship. Only yesterday I learnt, to my surprise, that you trice puddings athwart the starboard gumbrils when sealing by and large."
Graham's surprise was nothing to that of the wardroom.
"By and large," they said, "gumbrils? Starboard gumbrils?"
Jack's spotted dog hung in his gullet for a moment, before he understood that someone had been practising upon the professor's credulity, an ancient naval form of wit, played off many and many a time on newly joined young gentlemen, on himself long, long ago, and by Pullings and Mowat on Dr. Maturin in former years, but never, to his knowledge, on any man of Graham's eminence.
"Puddings we have, sir," he said, swallowing his own, "and plenty of them. There is the wreath of yarns tapering towards the ends and grafted all over that we clap about the fore and mainmasts, just below the trusses before we go into action, to prevent the yards from falling. Then there is the pudding on a boat's stem to act as a fender, and the puddings we lay round the anchor rings to stop them chafing. But as for gumbrils, why, I am afraid someone must have been practising on you. They do not exist."
The words were scarcely out of his mouth before he wished them back. He knew Stephen extremely well, and that detached, dreamy expression could only mean a consciousness of guilt.
"Unless," he added quickly, "it is some archaic term. Yes, I rather think—"
But it was too late. Captain Harris, the marine, was already explaining by and large. With a piece of fresh Gibraltar bread and arrows drawn with wine, he showed the ship lying as close as possible to the breeze.
"And this is sailing by the wind, or as sailors say in their jargon, on a bowline, whereas large is when it blows, not indeed quite from behind, but, say, over the quarter, like this."
"Far enough abaft the beam that the stunsails will set," said Whiting.
"So, as you see," continued Harris, "it is quite impossible to sail both by and large at the same time. It is a contradiction in terms." The expression pleased him, and he repeated, "A contradiction in terms."
"We do say by and large," said Jack. "We say a ship sails well by and large when she will both lie close when the wind is scant and run fast when it is free. No doubt that is what your informant meant."
"I think not, sir," said Graham. "I think your first supposition was correct. I have been practised upon. I am content. I shall see no more."
He did not look content. Indeed, he looked thoroughly displeased, in spite of a formal appearance of complacence. But he did say no more, no more at least to Dr. Maturin, except on one occasion. The dinner ran its course, the wine did its cheerful work, and by the time the port was on the table, the wardroom was filled with the comfortable noise of a party going well, laughter, and a great deal of talk. The young officers had found their tongues, a decent loquacity, and riddles were propounded. Mowat obliged the company with a piece about dealing with light airs abaft the beam, beginning, "With whining postures now the wanton sails spread all their charms to snare the inconstant gales. The swelling studsails now their wings extend, the staysails sidelong to the breeze ascend." And Stephen, aware that he had not only behaved badly, but that his bad behaviour had been discovered, took advantage of a pause between two songs to say that, unless the wind came fair tomorrow, he intended to go ashore to buy a raven at the shop of the Jewman from Mogador, famous for birds of all kinds, including ravens,
to see whether it was true that they lived 120 years.
A pale, flabby little joke, but one that had made people laugh for 2,500 years. It made them laugh now, after a moment's consideration. But Dr. Graham said,
"It is very unlikely that you will live so long yourself, Dr. Maturin. A man already so advanced in years, and with such habits, cannot pretend to live to such an age. 120 years, forsooth."
They were the last words he said to Stephen, until the Worcester was lying off Port Mahon in Minorca, having sailed from Gibraltar the moment the wind came far enough north of east. She now had a leading breeze for Mahon itself, but nothing, not even his respect for learning and his consideration for Professor Graham, would induce Jack to take her into that long harbour, easy to enter, but the very devil to leave except with a northerly air. Many a time he had seen line-of-battleships windbound there in former days, when he and his little Weatherly brig could just beat out, but only just. And with Admiral Thornton's squadron not 2 days' sail away, if the breeze held true, he did not intend to lose a minute, even if begged to do so by a choir of virgins on their knees. The Worcester lay to, therefore, off Cape Mola, and Mr. Graham was lowered into a boat, though at least he was indulged in the relative comfort of the pinnace. He gave Stephen a cold, "Good day to you," and was gone. Stephen watched the pinnace hoist its sails and speed away over the short, choppy sea, sprinkling its occupants at every plunge and soaking them quite often. He was sorry that he had offended Graham, who was a strong, intelligent man, no cloistered scholar, and no sort of a bore at any time. But such a degree of resentment was unamiable, and he saw him go without much regret.
"And in any event," he reflected, "he will never again think of me as a potential intelligence agent, still less as one in fact, dear Mother of God."
"Shearwaters!" cried a voice beside him. "Surely they cannot be Shearwaters here!"
Stephen turned and saw Mr. Martin, the only remaining parson, the thinner and shabbier of the two literary gentlemen.
"Certainly they are Shearwaters," he said. "Do they not nest in holes on Cape Mola over there? To be sure they are less sharply black and white than those over the Atlantic, but they are Shearwaters for all that. The same voice by night in their burrows, the same solitary white egg, the same grossly obese chick. See how they turn with the wave? Certainly they are Shearwaters. You have studied birds, sir?"
"As much as ever I could, sir. They have always been my great delight. but since I left the university I've had little leisure, little opportunity for reading, and I have never been abroad."
What with his wound and the superabundance of clergymen, Stephen had had almost no contact with Mr. Martin. But now his heart warmed to this young man who shared his passion, who had learnt a great deal and who had paid for his learning with long journeys on foot, nights spent in byres, haystacks, sheepcots, even prisons when he was taken up for a poacher, and with the loss of an eye, destroyed by an owl.
"The poor bird only meant to protect her brood. She could not tell I meant them no harm. I was culpably abrupt in my movements. Besides, it is convenient, when looking through a spyglass, not to have to close the other eye."
They exchanged accounts of the bustard, the osprey, the stilt, the cream-coloured courser, and Stephen was describing the great albatross with an eagerness approaching enthusiasm when he heard Captain Aubrey say, in a tone of strong displeasure,
"Loose the topsail! Give him a gun!"
It was the conduct of the returning pinnace that caused these remarks. To Stephen it seemed to be coming along well enough, beating into the wind, tacking briskly from time to time. But it was clear from the look of the other officers on the quarter-deck that Mr. Summers was not handling the boat to their satisfaction. At one point they all shook their heads in unison, frowning with disapproval, and in fact a moment later a spar carried away, a spar that might be replaced in Malta but not much nearer at hand. When the pinnace came alongside with a rending crack, Captain Aubrey said,
"Mr. Pullings, I should like to see Mr. Summers in the cabin,"
and walked off. Summers came out of the cabin 10 minutes later, red-faced and sullen. The quarter-deck was full of officers and young gentlemen, watching Minorca dwindle on the larboard quarter as the ship stood northeast for her rendezvous with the Admiral. A glance showed Summers's state of mind, and they all studiously avoided his eye as he paced up and down for a while before going below. He was still in a surly, resentful mood when the wardroom met for supper, and they tried to cheer him up. It had long been obvious to all the sailors present that he was no seaman, but they all knew the importance of good relations in a small community, tight-packed, always on top of one another, with no possibility of getting away throughout the whole length of the commission. But Summers did not choose to be brought into a happier state of mind. Where he had served his time they could not tell, but it must have been in some ship that did not observe the conventions they had always known, one of which was that any unpleasantness on deck was forgotten, at least pretended to be forgotten, at table. Towards the end of the meal he grew more conversable, talking to Mr. Martin and the younger Marine Lieutenant Jackson, who admired him for his good looks, his comparative wealth, and his connections. Without mentioning any names, he explained to them the difference, as he saw it, between bosun captains and gentleman captains, the first being those who paid great attention to mechanical duties, the province of mere mariners, the second being the true soul of the Navy, high-spirited men who left such things to their inferiors, reserving all their energies for a superior general direction and for battle, in which they led their men, who respected, almost worshipped them, incomparably well. He grew almost as enthusiastic about gentlemen as Stephen had been about the wandering albatross. The common people instinctively recognized blood and accepted its superiority. They knew that a man of ancient lineage was, as it were, of another essence, and they could distinguish him at once, almost as though he wore a halo. Young Jackson abounded in his sense, applauding his higher flights, until he happened to look along the table and saw the grave faces of his companions, when a certain doubt came over him, and he fell silent. By this time Summers was too drunk to notice that, or to attend to the strong, determined conversation that drowned his voice. He was, in fact, so drunk even by naval standards, that he was obliged to be bundled into his cot. This was usual enough, and since he had no watch to keep that night, there was no adverse comment. The purser was regularly speechless by lights out, though the Worcester was not reckoned a hard-drinking ship by any means. But his state the next morning was far from usual. He was so unwell that Stephen, having prescribed 3 drams of Lucatellus's balsam, told him that he might perfectly well decline the captain's invitation to dinner on grounds of health. Summers was touchingly grateful for Dr. Maturin's attentions, and as he walked off Stephen reflected that he had often known men who were showy and arrogant in public, men with little instinctive social tact, to be pleasant enough with only one companion. He offered this reflection, in general terms, to Mr. Martin as they sat on the poop, under a cloudless sky after their dinner with the captain, gazing at the white-flecked, pure-blue sea and the various gulls that wantoned in the wake. But Martin was too full of the bustard, the great Andalusian bustard bought in Gibraltar, that had formed the main dish, to give more than a civil assent before returning to that noble fowl. "To think that I should have lain 3 nights in a shepherd's hut on Salisbury Plain, a hut on wheels, in the hope of seeing one at dawn, to say nothing of my vigils in Lincolnshire, and that I should have found a cockbird on my plate in the bosom of the ocean. It is very like a dream." He was also full of enthusiasm for the Navy. Such kindness in the captain, such cordial hospitality, none of the cold formal distance or hauteur he had been led to expect. And the gentlemen of the wardroom were so friendly and considerate. He could not speak too highly of Mr. Pullings's and Mr. Mowat's amiability. The other officers had been very good to him too, while the comfort of his little cabin, in spite of the enormous gun and the, he might almost say, the luxury of their fare, with wine every day, quite astonished him. Stephen glanced to see whether he was speaking ironically, but all he could detect was honest pleasure and satisfaction, together with a rosy gleam from Captain Aubrey's port. "Sure we are fortunate in our shipmates," he observed, "and I have noticed that many sea officers, nay, the majority, are of the same cheerful, good-natured, liberal stamp. Coxcombs are rare, reading men not unknown. Yet from the physical point of view, the nautical life is usually represented as one of hardship, discomfort, and privation." "All things are relative," said Martin, "and perhaps some years of living in a garret or a cellar and working for the booksellers is no bad preparation for the Navy. At all events, it is the life for me, both as a naturalist and as a social being. I am—"
"By your leave, sir," said the captain of the afterguard, coming up the poop ladder with a horde of swabbers.
"What's afoot, Miller?" asked Stephen.
"Which we hope to raise the flag before long," said Miller. "And you would not wish the Admiral to see the deck all covered knee-deep with filth, sir, would you now? With remarks passed through all the fleet?"
The filth was not discernible to a landsman's eye, unless it were for a very slight dusting of little pieces of worn tow fallen from the rigging and gathered under the lee of the rail. But Stephen and the parson were chivied off the poop to the quarter-deck. 5 minutes later the tide of powerful cleaners dislodged them once again, and they moved on to the gangway.
"Should you not like to go below, sir?" asked Whiting, the officer of the watch. "The wardroom is almost dry by now."
"Thank you," said Stephen, "but I wish to show Mr. Martin a Mediterranean gull. I believe we shall go to the forecastle."
"Oh, we'll have your chair sent forward," said Pullings. "But you will not touch anything, will you, Doctor? Everything is quite clean, fit for the Admiral's inspection."
"You are very good, Mr. Pullings," said Stephen, "but I can walk and stand quite well now. I do not need the chair, although I am sensible of your attention."
"You will not touch anything, Doctor," called Pullings after them.
And on the forecastle a midshipman and 2 elderly sheet-anchor men desired them to take great care and to touch nothing. They were unwelcome and in the way. But after a while Joseph Place, an old shipmate of Stephen's and a forecastle hand, brought them each a cheese-shaped bag of bow-chaser wads, and there they sat in comfort, touching neither the beautifully Flemished falls nor the gleaming gun-sights.
"The Navy is the life for me," said Martin again, "quite apart from the excellent company, and I may say that as far as I have seen the ordinary sailormen are quite as obliging as the officers."
"I have certainly found it so in many cases. Aft the more honour, forward the better man, as Lord Nelson put it," said Stephen. "Aft being the officers and young gentlemen, forward the hands. The container for the contents, you understand.
Yet I think that by forward we ought to take him to mean real sailors, for you are to observe that in a crew such as this a great many scrovies are necessarily swept in, froward, dirty, disreputable, rough, good-for-nothing, disorderly ragabashes and rapparees to begin with, and sometimes forever."
Martin bowed and went on.
"Apart from that, and only to be mentioned long after, there is the material aspect. I must beg pardon, sir, for alluding to such a subject, but unless a man has earned his bread by a calling in which he must rely on himself alone, in which any failure of invention, any bout of sickness is fatal, he can scarcely appreciate the extraordinary comfort of a certain £150 a year. £150 a year! Good heavens! And I am told that if I consent to act as schoolmaster to the young gentlemen, an annual fee of £5 a head is due for each."
I conjure you to do no such thing. There is a Mediterranean gull just perched on the long pole running out in front. You see her heavy, dark red bill, the true blackness of her head? Quite different from Ridibundus.
Quite different. At close range there is no possible confusion.
But pray, sir, why must I not teach the young gentleman?
Because, sir, teaching young gentlemen has a dismal effect upon the soul. It exemplifies the badness of established artificial authority. The pedagogue has almost absolute authority over his pupils. He often beats them, and insensibly he loses the sense of respect due to them as fellow human beings. He does them harm, but the harm they do him is far greater. He may easily become the all-knowing tyrant, always right, always virtuous. In any event, he perpetually associates with his inferiors, the king of his company, and in a surprisingly short time, alas, this brands him with the mark of Cain. Have you ever known a schoolmaster fit to associate with grown men? The dear knows I never have. They are most horribly warped, indeed. Yet, curiously enough, this does not seem to apply to tutors. Perhaps it is scarcely possible to play the prima donna to an audience of one. Fathers, on the other hand.
Mr. Pudding's compliments, sir, said a young gentleman, and begs Dr. Maturin will take his feet off the fresh paint.
Stephen gazed at him, and then at his feet. It was quite true. The glistening surface of the carronade that served him for a footstool gleamed not as he had supposed, with polish, nor yet with spray, but with jet-black paint, newly laid on.
"My compliments to Mr. Pullings," he said at last, "and pray desire him to let me know, at his leisure, how I am to take my feet off the fresh paint, without instantly and indelibly marking both the deck here and at every step I take to the main staircase. These bandages are not likely to be taken off. And in any case, sir," to Mr. Martin, "the question hardly arises, for as you remarked yourself, you found a Pythagorean proposition impossible to be understood, and the education of the young gentleman aboard is almost all a matter of trigonometry, even of algebra, heaven preserve us."
"Then I must abandon my midshipman, I see," said Martin, smiling. "But still I feel that the Navy is the life for me, an ideal life for a naturalist."
"To be sure, it is a very fine life for a young man with no ties on land and with a robust constitution, a young man who is not over-nice about his victuals, and who does not make a god of his belly. And I am of your opinion entirely, in believing the better kind of sea officer to be excellent company. Though there are others, and the position of authority can sap a captain with the unhappiest effects upon the whole ship's company. Then again, if it is your misfortune to have a bore or a petulant coxcomb aboard, you are penned up with him for months and even years on end, so that his shortcomings grow exquisitely tedious, and the first words of his often repeated anecdotes a hellish torment. And as to its being a life for a naturalist, why, it has advantages, to be sure. But you are to consider that the Navy's prime function is to take, burn, or destroy the enemy, not to contemplate the wonders of the deep. The utmost power of language is not enough to describe the frustration a naturalist must endure in this jading pursuit of merely political, material ends. Had we been allowed some days ashore at Menorca, for example, I could have shown you not only the black wheat ear, not only the curious Menorcan chat, but Eleonora's falcon, the bearded vulture."
"I'm sure what you say is profoundly true," said Martin, "and I bow to your experience. I shall nourish no illusions. And yet, sir, you have seen the great albatross, the southern petrels, the penguins in their interesting diversity, sea elephants, the cassowary of the far Spice Islands, the emu scouring the sultry plain, the blue-eyed shag. You have beheld Leviathan."
"I have also seen the three-toed sloth," said Dr. Maturin.
"Sail ho!" called the lookout at the foremast head. "On deck there! Four sails a ship's, six sail a squadron. Fine on the larboard bow."
"That will be Sir John Thornton's fleet," said Stephen. "Presently we must make ourselves trim. Perhaps we might call the ship's barber."
Captain Aubrey, as trim as his newly brushed best uniform could make him, the Nile medal in his buttonhole, the regulation sword at his side — Admiral Thornton was a stickler for etiquette — went down the Worcester's side with the full naval ceremony, preceded by a midshipman with several packets under his arm. He was grave and silent as the barge pulled along the broad expanse of sea between the two ranges of towering line-of-battleships, stretching ahead and astern of the ocean, each exactly in station, two cable lengths apart. Although this was only a parenthesis in his career, a routine turn on the everlasting Toulon blockade with little likelihood of action, there was always the sea to cope with, the sudden savage winds of the Gulf of Lions, and the unexpected was always at hand. Admiral Thornton was himself an outstanding seaman. He required a very high degree of competence in his captains. He never hesitated to sacrifice individuals when he thought the good of the service was at issue. Many an officer had he set on the beach forever, and although Jack could hardly hope to distinguish himself during this parenthesis, it was quite possible that he might take a fall, particularly as Admiral Hart, the second in command, did not love him. His thoughts were more sombre, his face far less cheerful than usual. After the first few very active weeks of getting the Worcester into shape, weeks in which he had brought her gunnery to a moderately high standard of efficiency, the ship had settled into the steady naval way of life. A happy ship upon the whole, and since he had an excellent first lieutenant in Tom Pullings, he had had plenty of time to worry about his affairs at home, his horribly involved and dangerous legal affairs. He had retained little Latin from his brief, remote, and largely ineffectual days at school, but one tag still ran through his head, and the substance of it was that no ship could outrun care. The Worcester had run some 2,000 miles as fast as he could drive her, yet care still sat there, dispelled only by the great gun exercise and his evenings with Stephen, Scarlatti, old Bach, and Mozart. Bonden brought the barge kissing alongside the flagship. Jack was piped aboard with even greater ceremony, bosun's calls howling, marines presenting arms with a fine simultaneous clash. He saluted the quarter-deck, observed that the admiral was not there, saluted the captain of the fleet, shook hands with the captain of the ocean, took the packets from his midshipman, and turned to a man in black, the admiral's secretary, who led him below. The admiral looked up from the innumerable papers on his broad desk, said,
"Sit down, Aubrey. Forgive me for a moment,"
and went on writing. His pen squeaked. Jack sat there gravely, as well he might, for the man in front of him, brilliantly lit by the Mediterranean sun coming in through the stern window, was a pale, bald, bloated ghost of the Admiral Thornton he had known. A man without any glorious fleet action to his name, but with a great reputation as a fighting captain, and a greater one as an organizer and a disciplinarian. A man with a personality as strong as St. Vincent's, and not unlike him, except that he loathed flogging and paid much attention to religious observance, and that he was happily married. Jack had served under him, and although he had known many admirals since those days, he still found him as formidable as ever, shockingly aged and sick though he was. Jack sat there, considering the passage of time and its mutilations. He stared, hardly aware of what he was seeing, at the admiral's pale, bald head, with a few long streaks of grey hair on either side, until an old, old pug-dog, suddenly waking, set up a furious little din, waddled straight at his chair and bit him in the leg, if so nearly toothless a nip could be called a bite.
"Quiet, Tabby, quiet,"
said the admiral, scratching on. The pug retreated, snorting and growling, rolling her eyes and defying Jack from her cushion under the desk. The admiral signed his letter, put down his pen, and took off his spectacles. He made as if to rise, but sank back. Jack sprang to his feet, and the admiral stretched out his hand over the papers, looking up at him without much interest.
"Well, Aubrey," he said, "welcome to the Mediterranean. You have made a fairly good passage, considering the Levanter. I am glad they sent me a real seaman this time. Some of the people they wish on us are sad loobies. And I am glad to see you manage to persuade them to let you have sensible masts. Taunt, heavy sparred ships, above all if they are wall-sided, will never do for winter service here. Tell me, how do you find the Worcester?"
"I have her statement of condition here, sir," said Jack, taking one of his packets. "But perhaps first you will allow me to deliver this. When I did myself the honour of waiting upon her before we sailed, I promised Lady Thornton that it should be the first I gave you."
"Bless me! Letters from home!"
cried the admiral, and his dull, glaucous eyes took on their old life and gleam.
"And a couple from my girls, too. This is an epocha.
I've not heard from them since Excellent came in. Bless me, I take this very kindly in you, Aubrey. Upon my word, I do.
This time he rose from his chair, heaving his thick body up on his stick-like legs to shake Jack's hand again. And as he did so, he noticed the torn silk stocking, the little spot of blood.
"Has she bit you?"
he cried.
"Oh, I am so sorry. Tabby, you vile cur, for shame," he said, bending to cuff the pug.
She snapped at him without the least hesitation, never stirring from her cushion.
"She grows fractious in her old age," said the Admiral. "Like her master, I'm afraid. And she pines for a run on shore. Do you know, Aubrey, it is 13 months since I let go an anchor."
When the Admiral had leafed through the several covers and had glanced at his official correspondence to see whether there were any particularly urgent matters, they returned to the Worcester and Jack's wound. The ship did not detain them long. They both knew her and most of the other 40 thieves, and Jack was aware that the Admiral longed to be left alone with his letters. But Thornton repeatedly expressed his concern about the wound and the torn stocking.
"At least I can assure you that Tabitha ain't mad," he said, "only wanting in wits and discrimination. If she had been mad, there would scarcely be a flag officer left in the squadron, since she has nipped Admiral Hart, Admiral Mitchell, and the captain of the fleet again and again, particularly Hart, and not one of them has fallen into convulsions that I know of. But she is fractious, as I say, like her master. A good set to with the French would set us both up, make us young again, and let us go home at last."
"Is there any likelihood of their coming out, sir?"
"Maybe there is, maybe. Not immediately, of course, with this southern air and a steady glass. But the inshore squadron has reported a good deal of activity these last weeks. Lord, how I hope they make a dash for it!"
cried the Admiral, clasping his hands.
"God send they do, sir," said Jack, standing up. "God send they do!
Amen to that!"
said the Admiral, and rising with the roll of the ship, he walked to the door with Jack, observing as they parted,
"We are to have a court-martial tomorrow, I'm afraid. You will attend, of course. There is one particularly ugly case that I do not choose to leave over for Malta, and we will deal with the others at the same time. I wish it were done with. Oh, and I believe you have a Dr. Maturin aboard. I should like to see him at noon, and so would the physician of the fleet."
Chapter 4 Jack Aubrey dined with his particular friend Heneage Dundas, captain of the Excellent. They had been midshipmen and lieutenants together. They could speak quite openly. And when the scrappy meal was over, the Excellent's least meagre hen, boiled not to tenderness but string, and they were alone, Jack said,
"I was shocked to see the Admiral."
"I am sure you were," said Dundas. "So was I when I first came out and went aboard the flag. I've hardly set eyes on him since then, but they say he has grown much worse. Scarcely comes on deck except for half an hour or so in the cool of the evening, and hardly ever entertains. How did you find him?"
"Worn out. Completely worn out. He could barely get up from his chair. Legs as thin as broomsticks. What is the matter with him?"
"Keeping the sea is the matter with him. Keeping up this infernal blockade as strictly as ever he can, with old battered ships, most of them undermanned, and all of them short of stores, a worn-out squadron with some damned awkward troublesome captains, and an incompetent second-in-command. I tell you, Jack, it will be the death of him. I've only been here these 3 months, and I'm not half his age, but you know what a strict blockade is. Another world, quite cut off. Short commons, brown shirts, foul weather, the people bored and harassed with keeping exact station under the Admiral's eyes. And already the ship is like a prison. He has had years of it, far more than any other commander-in-chief."
"Why don't he go home, then? Why don't they relieve him?"
"Who could take over? Hart?"
They both gave a scornful laugh.
"Franklin?" suggested Jack. "Lombard? Even Mitchell? They're all seamen. They could manage a blockade. Franklin and Lombard did very well off Brest and Rochefort."
"But it is not only the blockade, you blockhead!" cried Dundas. "The Admiral could manage the blockade with one hand tied behind his back. If it were only the blockade, he would be as plump and rosy as you or me. Though I may say in passing, Jack, you seem to have lost a good deal of your blubber since last I saw you. I doubt you weigh 13 or 14 stone. No, if it were only the blockade, a score of men could relieve him. But quite apart from the French, he has the whole Mediterranean on his hands and everything that touches it. Catalonia, Italy, Sicily, the Adriatic, the Ionian, and the Turks, Egypt, the Barbary States. And I may tell you, Jack, the Barbary States are the very devil to deal with. I was sent to reason with the Dey, and I did so pretty well, although our consul tried to put a spoke in my wheel. I was very pleased with myself, until I put in again a few weeks later about some Christian slaves, and found that my Dey had been murdered by the soldiers, and that there was a new one in the palace, wanting a new agreement and a fresh set of presents. Whether the consul or the men with him had engineered the affair, I do not know, but the Foreign Office have some people there. Ned Burney recognized a cousin of his dressed up in a sheet.
"Surely civilians cannot poach on our ground, on the Commander-in-Chief's preserves?"
"They are not supposed to, but they do. So does the army, at least in Sicily. And that makes things even more complicated, though they were complicated enough in the first place, in all conscience, with dozens of rulers, great and small. You never know where you are with the Barbary States, but they are essential to our supplies. While the beys and pashas in Greece and up the Adriatic almost never obey the Turkish sultan, they are practically independent princes, and some of them are quite prepared to play booty with the French to gain their ends. The Sicilians cannot be relied upon, and apart from the fact that we must not provoke him at any price for fear of the French, I do not know just how we stand with the Turks. But the Admiral does. He has the whole cat's cradle of strings in his hands. You should see the feluccas and huarios and half-galleys that come to pick them up, particularly as instructions take so long coming out. We are often months and months without orders from the Admiralty, and without post either, and the Admiral has to play the ambassador and diplomat right, left, and centre, keeping all these rulers steady, as well as look after the squadron.
It would be difficult to replace him, of course, but they cannot really mean to leave him here till he works himself to death. If he dies, a new man must be sent out, and with no one to ease him into the command, he would be very much at a loss. In any case, people say he is asked to be relieved several times. Lady Thornton told me so herself.
"Yes, he has," said Dundas, and he hesitated. His elder brother was First Lord, and he was wondering how much confidential information he could decently pass on. "Yes, he has. But between you and me, Jack, between you and me, he has always left a loophole. He has always asked to be relieved in such a manner that they could press him to stay and he could yield. He has never sent in an ultimatum, and I do not believe the Admiralty knows how sick he is. They have sent him reinforcements, they have promoted his officers, and they have made him Major General of the Marines, and they think the situation is dealt with."
"Yet he longs to go home," said Jack. "A rum business."
"I think the explanation is this," said Dundas. "He longs to go home, and he ought to go home, but he longs even more for a fleet action with the French. While there is a possibility of that, and there is a very real possibility, since they outnumber us, it is my belief that he will stay. He will either have his battle, or die aboard his ship."
"Well," said Jack, "I honour him for it."
And once again he said,
"God send the French come out."
After a pause, he stood up.
"Thank you for my dinner, Hen," said he. "I have rarely drunk such capital port."
"It was very good of you to come," said Dundas. "I have been fairly pining for someone to talk to, glum as a jib cat and sick of my own company. There is precious little ship visiting on blockade. Sometimes I play chess, right hand against left hand, but there ain't much fun in that."
"What is your wardroom like?"
"Oh, they're a very decent set, upon the whole. They are mostly young men, of course, except for the Premier, who is old enough to be my father. I invite them in turn, and dine with them on Sundays, but they are not men I can unbend with, not as who should say really talk to, and the evenings drag on and on, unfriended, melancholy, slow," said Dundas, with a laugh. "They are people with whom you have to pose as a demigod from one noon observation to the next. I get very tired of it, and I doubt I play the part convincingly. You are most uncommon lucky to have Maturin. Give him my regards, will you? I hope he will find time to come across."
Maturin had every intention of coming across, being fond of Captain Dundas, but first he had to wait on the Admiral and the physician of the fleet. He was ready early in the morning. His uniform, having been thoroughly revised and brushed by Killick, had been passed by Jack at breakfast, and now he stood on the quarter-deck talking to Mr. Martin.
"'The ensign at the top of the middle mast indicates that Sir John Thornton is an admiral of the White,' he said. "'And, as you perceive, the ensign itself is also white, "'whereas that on the rear mast, or mizzen, as we say, of the large vessel to the left, is red, "'from which we are to understand that Mr. Hart is a rear admiral of the Red Squadron. "'Then again, could we see the flagship of Mr. Mitchell,' who commands the inshore squadron, we should find that it flies a blue flag, also on the rear mast, from which we should conclude that he is a rear admiral of the blue, and therefore subordinate to both Sir John Thornton and Mr. Hart, the order of the squadrons being the red, the white, and the blue. Three cheers for the red, white, and blue, said Mr. Martin. His spirits raised high by the spectacle of so many glorious men of war assembled under the brilliant morning sky. No less than 8 towering three-deckers and 4 more ships of the line besides the smaller vessels. Exactly squared yards, fresh paint and shining brass concealed the fact that many of them were fast wearing out under the perpetual stress of weather, that some, indeed, were already beyond their useful lives. And though a sailor would have noticed fished masts and twice laid stuff in the rigging, a landsman's eye saw no more than a hint of their true state in the patched sails and wind-frayed pennants. "'And the Union Jack on the Admiral's ship signifies the supreme command, no doubt?' "'I believe not, sir,' said Stephen. "'I am told that it is rather an indication of a court-martial having to be held in the forenoon. Perhaps you would like to attend.' Anyone may listen to the proceedings, and it might give you a more comprehensive view of the Royal Navy. "'It would be deeply interesting, I'm sure,' said Martin more soberly. "'Captain Aubrey is good enough to take me in his boat. It is preparing now, as you see, a capacious vehicle. I am sure that he would make room for you, and you would not find the flagship very difficult to get into. It is what we call a three-decker, and has a convenient door in the middle termed an entry-port.' I will ask him, if you wish, when he appears. That would be very kind, if you are sure I should not be importunate.
Martin broke off, and nodding towards the place not far from the hen-coops where some sheep and a lugubrious bloodhound were being aired, he said,
That child with the bull-calf, I see him every morning when I am up early enough. Pray, is it another naval custom? I am afraid it is, in a way. The puny young gentleman is Mr. Calamy. He longs to grow huge and powerful, gigantically strong, and some wicked older members of the midshipman's berth have told him that if he carries the calf on his shoulders a certain distance every day, his frame will insensibly become accustomed to the brute's gradually increasing weight, so that by the time it is a full-grown bull, he himself will be a second Milo of Crotona. It was a bishop's son that first set him on, I regret to say. See, he falls again. How eagerly he takes up his burden. They cheer him, the Judas band. It is a shame to abuse the poor lad so. The calf has kicked him. He masters the calf. He staggers on. And I'm sorry to say the officers encourage it. Even the captain encourages it. And here is the captain, ready to the moment.
Captain Aubrey was not, in fact, quite ready. Rats had got at his best cocked hat in the night. They were very troublesome and enterprising in the Worcester, but a few months of blockade would deal with that, since the foremast hands and the midshipmen would eat them, and Killick was busy on the gold lace. Automatically he glanced aloft, taking in the state of the sky, the trim of the sails, and the rigging, then fore and aft. His eye caught the little group on the larboard gangway. He smiled and called out in his strong, cheerful voice,
"'Clap on, Mr. Calamy! Never say die! Perseverance does it!'
The hat appeared. Jack clapped it on, and in reply to Stephen's request said,
"'Certainly, certainly. Smith, give Mr. Martin a hand down the side. Come, doctor.'
The barge shoved off, one of many converging upon the flagship for the court-martial. The captains gathered, and Jack greeted several old acquaintances, some of them men he cordially liked. But he hated these occasions— And when the court assembled, when the captain of the fleet had taken his seat as president, with the deputy judge-advocate and the members around him, and when the clerk had delivered to each a list of the cases to be tried, his face grew dark. There was the usual string of crimes too serious for a captain to deal with on his own, since most of them carried the death penalty, desertion, real or attempted, striking superiors, murder, sodomy, theft on an ambitious scale. Perhaps inevitable when some 10,000 men were brought together in these circumstances, many of them against their will. But there was also a series of accusations made by officers against officers. One member of a wardroom against another. Captains against lieutenants or masters for neglect of duty, disobedience or disrespect. Lieutenants against captains for oppression and tyranny, or language scandalous and unbecoming to the character of an officer, or drunkenness, or all three. He hated these cases. The evidence of bad blood and rancor in a service where decent relations were essential to efficiency, to say nothing of happiness among the people. He knew very well that men on a long blockade, almost entirely cut off from contact with home and the outside world, apparently forgotten, badly supplied, badly fed, keeping the sea in all weathers, were likely to grow sour, and that small offences, rankling, could grow to monstrous proportions. But even so he was distressed to see the length of this second section on the list. All the trouble came from three ships, the Thunderer, Hart's flagship, the Superb, and the Defender. Their officers must have been at loggerheads with one another, and with their captains, for months and months.
"At least," he reflected, "we shall not have time to get through more than a few of them, and then, what with exchanging and cooling down, most of the smaller charges will be withdrawn."
Upon the whole, he was right. A court-martial at sea being an exceptional affair, quite unsuited to the usual leisurely procedure in port. But even so they dealt with many more cases than he had expected. The judge-advocate, here the Admiral's secretary, Mr. Allen, being a keen-witted, energetic, methodical, quick-thinking man of business. They ran through the earlier, more routine cases with remarkable speed, and the sentences to death, or to being flogged round the fleet with 200, 300, and even 400 lashes, which amounted to much the same thing on occasion, plunged Jack's heart in gloom. Then, it appearing that the clerk accused of comforting the king's enemies, a most unusual case, and no doubt the reason for this most unusual sitting, had killed himself, the court proceeded to some of these nasty wardroom quarrels. In a way, Jack was relieved. He knew nothing of the clerk's case, but it might well have proved as monstrous as the one he had heard in Bombay, when a surgeon, an able, respected, but free-thinking man, was hanged for saying that he approved certain aspects of the revolution in France. And he wished to hear no more of the ghastly solemnity with which the judge-advocate told a wretched culprit that he was to be put to death, the more so since he knew that the commander-in-chief, a man as hard to others as he was to himself, would probably confirm every sentence. The disgruntled officers followed one another in a most disagreeable public washing of very dirty linen. Fellows, the captain of the Thunderer, appeared no less than three times, either as accused or accuser. A big, angry-looking man, with a red face and black hair. Charlton of the Superb and Marriott of the Defender, twice each. The court dealt with these cases tenderly. Often, when the proceedings were resumed after the members' deliberation, the judge-advocate would say, "The court, having maturely and deliberately considered the evidence, finds these charges partly proved. The sentence of this court is that you be reproved for petulance, and admonished to be more circumspect, and not to offend in a like manner for the future. And you are accordingly hereby reproved and so admonished." But one young man was dismissed his ship, and one who had been provoked into giving fellows a very rash answer was broke, dismissed the service. They were both from the Thunderer, and the conclusive evidence, the interpretation of the lieutenant's attitude and unwise gesture, came from Hart, who spoke with evident ill will. They turned to yet another case, a plain drunken murder on the lower deck this time, and as Jack listened sadly to the familiar evidence, he saw Martin watching with a tense, shocked expression on his white face.
"If he wanted to see the dirty side of the Navy, he could not have come to a better place," he reflected,
as a seaman bearing witness rambled on. "Which I heard the deceased abusing of the prisoner in a most dreadful manner. He first called him a Dutch galliot-built bugger, damned him, and asked how he came to be in the ship, or who brought him into her. Then he damned the person whoever did bring him. I could not afterwards make out what the deceased said, as he was in a horrid passion, but Joseph Bates, yeoman of the sheets, made him kiss his ass. He was no seaman." While the earlier cases were being heard, Stephen was with Dr. Harrington, the physician of the fleet, an old and esteemed acquaintance, a learned man with very sound ideas on hygiene and preventive medicine, but unhappily somewhat too gentle and timid for full effectiveness at sea. They talked of the squadron's remarkably good state of health, no scurvy, Sicily, and its orange groves being near at hand, a little venereal disease, the ships being so rarely in port, and the admiral forbidding all but the most unexceptionable women aboard, and very few even of them. No casualties from action, of course, and surprisingly few of the maladies usual to seamen, except in Thunderer, Superb, and Defender.
"I put it down largely to the use of wind sails to bring at least some fresh air below," said Harrington, "to the continual serving out of antiscorbutics, and to the provision of wholesome wine instead of their pernicious rum. Although it must be admitted that happiness, comparative happiness, is a most important factor. In this case, where there is often dancing on the forecastle and stage plays, and an excellent band, we have almost no sickness. In the three ships I have mentioned, where the diet, the wind sails, and the antiscorbutics are exactly the same, the surgeons have their hands full." "Indeed, the effect of the mind on the body is extraordinarily great," observed Stephen. "I have noticed it again and again. And we have innumerable authorities, from Hippocrates to Dr. Cheney. I wish we could prescribe happiness."
"I wish we could prescribe common sense," said Harrington. "That might be at least a first step towards it. But there is so strong a resistance to change in the official mind, with so stubborn and dogged a clinging to tradition, however evil, in the seamen, that sometimes I grow discouraged. Yet I must admit that the Admiral, though a difficult patient himself, supports me in all the reforms I try to introduce."
"A difficult patient?"
"I should scarcely go too far if I were to say an impossible patient. Disobedient, masterful, doses himself. I have ordered him home I do not know how many times. I might as well have spoken to the ship's figurehead. I regret it extremely, but he tells me that he has consulted you before. You must know what kind of a patient he is."
"What is his present state?"
Harrington made a hopeless gesture.
"When I have said that there is a tabes of the inferior members and a generalized severe and progressive lowering of the whole constitution, I have said all I can usefully say."
He nevertheless went on to give a more detailed picture of decline.
"Great loss of physical strength in spite of adequate digestive and eliminatory functions, a wasting of the legs, little or no exercise, occasional seasickness, disturbing after so many years at sea, and dangerous in such a reduced condition, lack of sleep, extreme irascibility."
"Is there any imbecility of will?"
"Heavens, no! His mind is as sharp and clear as ever it was, but his task is beyond the powers of a man his age. It is beyond the powers of a man of any age that is not in perfect health. Could you imagine dealing not only with the management of a large and often troublesome fleet, but with all the affairs of the Mediterranean as well, particularly of the Eastern Mediterranean with its devious, shifting politics? He's at it 14 and 15 hours a day, hardly finding time to eat, still less to digest. And all this is required of a man whose education has been that of a sailor, no more. It is required of him for years on end. I wonder the strain has not killed him before this. My prescriptions, my bark and steel, may do some good, but short of going home there is only one thing that will set him squarely on his feet again."
"What is that?"
"Why, an action with the French, a victorious fleet action with the French. You spoke of the effect of mind upon matter just now. I am convinced that if the French were to come out of Toulon, and if they could be brought to action, Sir John would throw off his weakness. He would eat again, he would take exercise, he would be happy, vigorous, and young. I remember the change in Lord Howe after the 1st of June. He was about 70 and old for his age, sitting in an elbow chair on the old Charlotte's quarter-deck at the beginning of the battle, mortally tired from want of sleep.
By the end, he was in the prime of life, following every move, giving the clear, exact orders that won the victory. And so he continued for years and years. Black Dick, we used to call him.
Dr. Harrington looked at his watch.
However, he said, you will be seeing our patient in a little while, and perhaps you will put your finger on some peccant organ that I have missed. But before that I should like to show you a very odd case. A case, or rather a cadaver, that puzzles me.
He led the way below, and there, in a small triangular room lit by a scuttle, lay the case in question. A young man arched backwards so that only his head and heels touched the deck. His face set in so agonized a grin that his mouth reached almost to his ears. He was still in irons, and the ship being on an even keel, the broad leg shackles kept him in position.
"He was the Maltese clerk," said Harrington, "a linguist employed by the Admiral's secretary for Arabic documents and so on. There was some question of his having made a wrong use of them. I do not know the details, but they would have come out at the court-martial had he lived to stand his trial. What do you make of it?"
"I should have said tetanus without hesitation," said Stephen, feeling the corpse.
"Here is the most characteristic opisthotonus you could possibly wish, the trismus, the risus sardonicus, the early rigor. Unless indeed he could have taken a wild overdose of St. Ignatius's beans, or a decoction of their principle."
"Just so," said Harrington, "but how could he have come at the draught with his hands in irons? It puzzles me."
"Pass the word for Dr. Maturin! Pass the word for Dr. Maturin!"
The cry ran along the decks from the Admiral's cabin, and reached them as they stood gazing at the corpse. Stephen had seen a good deal of the Admiral in earlier years, when Sir John was a member of the Board of Admiralty, a junior lord who had to do with intelligence. He knew the reason for Stephen's presence in the Mediterranean, and he said,
"I understand your possible rendezvous on the French coast is not for the immediate future, and that you wish to go to Barcelona before that. Now, as far as Barcelona is concerned, there is no difficulty. Any one of the victuallers can set you down and bring you back to Mahon when you wish. But the French coast is clearly a matter for a man of war, and as I am very short of sloops and avisos, I have it in contemplation to make the return of one of the ships of the line to Mahon coincide with your visit. Perhaps the Thunderer is most in need?"
"If her need is not particularly urgent, sir," said Stephen, "I should infinitely prefer it if the Worcester might be sent. Indeed, from my point of view, that would be the ideal solution. Taking me and those I may bring with me off that coast is likely to be a delicate business, and Captain Aubrey is used to expeditions of this kind. We have nearly always sailed together. He is also a very discreet man, which is a point of great importance for any future undertaking of a similar character."
The pug had been staring at Stephen from the time he came in, sniffing in his direction. Now she walked across the deck, bowing and wagging what tail she possessed. She made a heavy spring into his lap and sat there, wheezing, gazing into his face and smelling strong.
"I know he is a fine seaman, and no one can possibly question his courage," said the Admiral, with something like a smile lighting his grey face. "But I do not believe that I have heard him called discreet before."
"Perhaps I should have added the qualification at sea. Captain Aubrey is very discreet at sea."
"Very well," said the Admiral. "I shall see what can be done."
He put on his spectacles, made a note, held it at arm's length, and placed it on one of the many heaps of exactly squared documents. Then, wiping his spectacles, he said,
"Tabby likes you, I see. She is a rare judge of character. I'm very glad that you are come out, Maturin. I am sadly at a loss for intelligence, although Mr. Allen, my secretary, has gathered a certain amount of local talent, and we had Sir Joseph's colleague, Mr. Waterhouse, until the French caught him on shore and shot him. That was a shocking loss."
"Did he know that I was coming out?"
"He knew that a gentleman was coming, no more. But if he had known that the gentleman was Dr. Maturin, I do not think you need fear any disclosure. Waterhouse was the most secret man I have ever known, though he seemed so open. Volte sciolto, pensieri stretti, indeed. Allen and I learned a great deal from him.
But even so, we are often far to seek, and the French have some very clever fellows in Constantinople and Egypt. And even in Malta, I'm afraid. Alan had a Maltese clerk who must have been selling them copies of our papers for months before we caught him. They will be trying him today, he said, glancing upwards to the captain's great cabin, where the court-martial sat. And I must admit I am most uneasy about the outcome. We cannot ask a gathering of English sea officers to accept the raison d'état, yet we cannot hang him without their sentence. On the other hand, we cannot produce the documents. There is far too much loose talking already. Nor can we gag the fellow to prevent him from giving evidence that will reveal too much. How I hope Alan will handle the matter cleverly. He came along surprisingly under Mr. Waterhouse's tuition.
I am sure he did, said Stephen. I understand Mr. Alan is an able, determined man.
He is both, thank God, and he does his very best against the interlopers who make a difficult situation even worse.
You allude to the gentlemen of the Foreign Office, I collect?
Yes, and to those from Lord Weymouth's service. The army gives me a certain amount of trouble, too, with strange, unauthorized alliances and promises. But that is only in Sicily and Italy, whereas the consuls and the people in the consulates are to be found everywhere, each with his own little plot and his local allies, trying to put in a ruler of his own, particularly in the smaller Barbary states. Bless me, you would think that we were pursuing half a dozen different policies at once, with no central direction or authority. They order these things better in France.
Stephen mastered a strong desire to contradict, and said, "Now, sir, by no means the least important reason for my being aboard this ship is to consult with Dr. Harrington about your health. I have heard his views. Now I must examine you."
"Another time," said the Admiral. "I go along well enough for the moment. Anno Domini and too much paperwork is the only trouble. I have not half an hour to call my own. But Mungo's cordial keeps me in reasonable trim. I understand my own constitution."
"Please to take off your coat and breeches," said Stephen impatiently. "Personal inclination is neither here nor there. The health of the Commander-in-Chief is of great concern to the entire fleet, to the entire nation, nor is it to be left in unqualified hands. Let us hear no more of Mungo's cordial." No single peccant organ did he find in his long and careful examination, but rather a general malfunction of the entire being, harassed beyond its power of endurance. "When I have consulted with Dr. Harrington," he said at last, "I shall bring some physic over, and I will see it drunk. But I must tell you, sir, the French are the cure for disease."
"You are in the right of it, Doctor," cried the Admiral. "I am sure you are in the right of it."
"Is there any probability of their coming out in the next 2 or 3 months? I say 2 or 3 months, advisedly, sir."
"I believe there is, but what haunts me is the thought that they may slip out without our knowing. What the gentlemen in London cannot be made to understand is that the blockade of a port like Toulon is a very chancy thing. The French have but to carry their telescopes up to the heights behind the town when the wind blows hard in the north, when we are blown off our station, to see how we bear and so avoid us. With a northerly breeze the air is almost always clear, and they can see for 50 miles up there. I know that 2 of their ships slipped out last month, and there may be more. If their fleet escaped me, it would break my heart. Much more than that, it might turn the scale of the war. And time is against me. The squadron is fast wearing out. Every time the Mistral blows we lose some spars. Our precious masts are sprung, and our ships strain even more, while the French sit tight in port, building as fast as ever they can. If the French don't beat us, the weather will." As he put on his clothes, he nodded to the deck above and said, "They are taking a devilish long time about it." He sat at his desk again, collecting his thoughts. "I will deal with these while we wait for Mr. Alan," he said, breaking the seal of a letter. He stared at it, said, "I must get stronger spectacles. Read me this, will you, Maturin? If it is what I hope for, I must begin preparing my answer at once."
"It is from Mohammed Ali, Pasha of Egypt," said Stephen, taking the letter and helping the pug onto his knee again. "It was dated from Cairo on the 2nd of this month, and it runs,
"'To the excellent among the chiefs of the Christian powers, "'the moderator of the princes of the religion of Jesus, "'the possessor of sage counsel and luminous and abundant talent, "'the expounder of the truth, the model of courtesy and politeness, "'our true and real friend Thornton, admiral of the English fleet. "'May his end be happy, and his course marked with brilliant and great events.' After many compliments to your excellency, we inform you, most illustrious friend, that we have received your kind letters translated into Arabic, and have read them, and understand your advice, as beautifully expressed as it is wise, respecting the management and defence of our ports. Your assurance that you preserve a regard for an old and sincere friend, and your sage counsels, have given us infinite content and joy. You shall ever have proofs of our abundant friendship and of our respectful attention, and we implore God to give effect thereto, and to preserve you ever in respect and esteem.
Several, said the admiral, but he evades the issue, of course. Not a word about the real point of my communication.
I see that he speaks of letters in Arabic.
Yes. In principle the Navy writes to foreigners in English, but where I want things done quick I send them unofficial copies in a language they can understand whenever I can. Even without that wretched Maltese, we have clerks for Arabic and Greek. French we can manage for ourselves, and that answers for most other purposes. But we are very much at a loss for Turkish. I should give a great deal for a really reliable Turkish translator. Now this one, if you will be so good.
From the Pasha of Bakr. He gives no date, but begins... Thanks to God alone, to the Admiral of the English fleet, peace be to you, etc. We are told of the amicable way in which you treat our people, and we are informed of the truth of it, and that you deal friendly with the Moors. We shall serve you in anything that may be possible with the greatest pleasure. Before this time another Pasha had the command, but now he is dead and I have the command, and everything that you may be in want of will be attended to, please God. The consul of your nation residing here treats us in a very bad way, and we wish that he may behave and speak with us in a better manner, and we will act accordingly as we always did. It is customary, when a new pasha is appointed, to send some person to congratulate him. Mohammed, Pasha of Barka.
Yes, said the admiral, I've been expecting this. Mohammed sounded us some time ago to find whether we should help him to depose his brother, Jafar. But it did not suit, Jafar being a good friend of ours, while as we knew very well, both from his reputation and from intercepted letters, that Mohammed was hand in glove with the French, who promised to set him up in his brother's place. It is probable that the ships that got out of Toulon went there for the purpose.
He considered for a while.
I must find out whether the French are still there, which is very likely,
he went on.
Then I rather think I can confound his knavish tricks— by provoking them into a breach of his neutrality. Once they fire a shot, he is committed, and I can send a powerful detachment, restore Jafar, who is in Algiers, and perhaps catch the Frenchmen at the same time. Yes, yes. The next, if you please.
The next, sir, is from the Emperor of Morocco, and it is addressed to the King of England by the hand of the Admiral of his glorious fleet. It begins, In the name of God, Amen. He is our first, our Father, and all our faith is reposed in him. From the servant of God, whose sole confidence is in him, the head of his nation, Suleiman, offspring of the late emperors Mahomet, Abdullah, and Ismail, sheriffs from the generation of the faithful, the emperor of great Africa, in the name of God and by his order, the lord of his kingdom, emperor of Morocco, Fez, Tafilat, Drach, Suez, etc., To His Majesty of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland, King George III, Defender of the Faith, etc., etc., and worthiest and best of kings, commanding Great Britain, Ireland, etc., 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 the glory of his country, Duke of Brunswick, etc., etc., may the Lord grant him long life and happiness throughout his days. We had the honour to receive Your Majesty's letter, which was read before us, and were happy to be assured of your friendship, which we had before learned from your favours and attention to our wishes concerning our agents and subjects, for which please to accept our warmest and most sincere thanks, Your Majesty may rely on it that we shall do everything in our power to assist your subjects in our dominions, and also your troops and vessels which may touch at our ports. We pray to the Almighty never to dissolve the friendship which has subsisted between our ancestors for so many years, but that it may be increased to the end of our generations, and we are always ready, at your Majesty's command, to do anything that may contribute to your happiness or that of your subjects. Before we had written this, our express orders were that all British ships that might touch at any of our ports should be supplied with a double allowance of provisions, and all that they might stand in need of, and we are ever ready, as we before said, to attend to your commands. We conclude with our most fervent prayers for your Majesty's health, peace, and happiness.
I am heartily glad of that, said the Admiral. These sources of supply are of the first importance to us, and the Emperor is a man one may rely upon. Oh, I wish I could say the same of the Beys and Pashas of the Adriatic, to say nothing of certain European rulers. Ah, Alan, here you are at last. Dr. Maturin, allow me to name Mr. Alan, my secretary. Dr. Maturin.
They bowed, looking attentively at one another.
How did the court go? Asked the Admiral.
Very well, sir, said Alan. We got through a surprising amount of business, and I have some death sentences for your confirmation. It was not necessary to try the Maltese. He died before his case came up. It is supposed he poisoned himself.
Poisoned himself? Cried the Admiral,
fixing Alan with a stern, penetrating look. Then the life faded. He muttered,
What does one man matter after all?
And bent his grey face over the sentences, confirming them one by one with his careful signature. The calm lasted through the night, and in the morning, despite a threatening sky, a falling barometer, and a prophetic swell from the southeast, the sentences were carried out. Mr. Martin's ship still being absent, he had spent the night with two condemned men aboard the Defender, which had no chaplain. He walked beside each through the entire ship's company assembled, boats from the whole squadron attending, in a heavy silence, to the point under the foreyard arm where each had his last tot of rum before his hands were tied, his eyes blindfolded, and the noose was fitted round his neck. Martin was much shaken by the time he returned to the Worcester, but when all hands were called on deck to witness punishment, he took what he conceived to be his place among them, next to Stephen, to watch the horrible procession of armed boats escorting those men who were to be flogged round the fleet.
"I do not think I can bear this,"
he said in a low voice, as the third boat stopped alongside their ship, and the provost marshal read out the sentence for the seventh time, the legal preliminary to another 20 lashes, this time to be inflicted by the Worcester's boatswain's mates.
"It will not last much longer," said Stephen. "There is a surgeon in the boat, and he can stop the beating when he sees fit. If he has any bowels, he will stop it at the end of this bout."
"There are no bowels in this pitiless service," said Martin. "How can those men ever hope for forgiveness? Barbarous, barbarous, barbarous! The boat is awash with blood," he added, as though to himself.
"In any case, this will be the last, I believe. The wind is rising. See how the captain and Mr. Pullings look at the sails."
"God send it may blow a hurricane," said Mr. Martin.
It blew. It blew. Not indeed a hurricane, but a wet wind out of Africa that came at first in heavy gusts, tearing the spray from the top of the rollers, clearing some of the degrading filth from the boats used for punishment. The flagship threw out the signal for hoisting all boats in, for making sail, for taking station in line abreast, for steering west-northwest. And the squadron headed for the coast of France, raising the topsails of the inshore squadron within 2 hours, the hills behind Toulon looming through the rain on the horizon, a little firmer than the clouds. And there a caique from the Adriatic found the flagship with still more letters for the Admiral's overloaded desk. Encouraging news from the inshore squadron, however, the frigates that plied continually between Cape Sissier and Porquerolles, standing right in to the extreme range of the guns on the hillside whenever the wind served, reported that the French had moved 3 more ships of the line into the outer road, and that they now lay there with the rest, yards crossed and ready for sea. On the other hand, it was confirmed that 174, the Archimede, and 1 heavy frigate, probably the Junon, had slipped out in the last blow but one, their destination unknown. This still left Emeriel,
the French admiral, a theoretical 26 sail of the line, 6 of them 3-deckers, and 6 40-gun frigates, as against Thornton's 13 of the line, and a number of frigates that varied so much according to the admiral's needs in remote parts of the Mediterranean that he could rarely count on more than 7 at any one time. It was true that several of the French ships were newly launched, and that their crews had little experience apart from cautious manoeuvring between Cape Brun and the headland of Carcaran, and that others were undermanned. But even so, the enemy could certainly bring out a superior force, something in the nature of 17 efficient line-of-battle ships, and since Emeriard had recently been sent a capable, enterprising second-in-command, Cosmao Kerjulian, it was by no means unlikely that they should do so.